Welcome to JTS. I'm David Kramer. I'm the director of the library here. And it is our pleasure and privilege to offer these book talks and invite authors to speak about all kinds of very, very fascinating things. Tonight, it is our pleasure to welcome Wendy Zierler to JTS. I know you had to come all the way uptown from your professional home, right? But downtown from your actual home, right? So you're on the way back, right? I have to say, we didn't get copies of the book until earlier today, so I confess to only having had a chance to dip into it and pick up as much as I could in the time subsequent to its shipping. But I have to say that this is, just a wonderful way to imagine doing something old in a very new way. One of the key terms, which I'm sure you will refer to quickly, is real theology. Not R-E-A-L, but R-E-E-L, real theology. And to create juxtapositions between works of art or expression that are meaningful and theological, inherited Jewish and other categories that create juxtapositions and connections which are instructive in ways that really provide us with an opportunity to think. I was totally surprised by the choice of the films, but that's the best part of any piece of scholarship or writing, is to teach someone something that they have never considered before. So I thank you for beginning that process for me, and now you'll have the opportunity to do it for the others who are here. Wendy Zierler.
Hello, everybody. So I'm just going to get I'm
going to occasionally be moving behind the monitor to be able to show clips. Thank you so much for coming. I know it's a cold evening, so it's especially lovely that you made the trek to join us. So I want to tell you a little bit about the origin of this book and its distinctive idiosyncratic form. I'm a professor of Jewish literature at Hebrew Union College downtown. And when I was first enlisted onto the faculty at HUC, literally just 2 weeks into my experience teaching there. I will just note that I started teaching at HUC in the fall of 2001, which was not exactly an auspicious time to move to New York and to be in lower, in almost lower Manhattan. Attendant to the shock of that experience, I guess the post-traumatic stress of that all, around that same time, I was approached by the elder colleague at the college at the time, who was the theologian Eugene Borowitz. I don't know if you know who he was, but he was, I don't think it's hyperbolic to say he was the leading liberal Jewish theologian of the 20th century. And he came up to me and said, I have this idea for a course that I want us to teach together. So you can imagine, and he was of the kind of ilk of professor with the booming voice, that kind of authoritative voice. I was the junior faculty member, among the first women hired there in a full-time position. He says, I have this idea of this course that I want to teach. I don't really know what I want to have in this course, but I know that I want to teach it. I want to teach it with you. And basically the principle is, years ago, I thought that it was important to reach Jews in the pews by teaching the books that they were reading anyway. And this was during the age of the breakthrough American Jewish writers. So when Philip Roth and Saul Bellow and Singer and so on were Barton Quinard Malamud, when they were the big thing, he felt that it was important. His congregants were going to be reading this material anyway, so try and find a way to make literature relevant and be a springboard for religious discussion. And he said, I know that no one's reading books anymore. I don't know if that's entirely true for this group, but that we've now become a screen culture. And so I think we should do something like that with movies. I think I have one idea of a film that I'd like to teach. The rest is up to you. I leave it up to you. Have a great time. So you can imagine, on the one hand, I was extremely elated to be approached by an elder colleague like this. On the other hand, I was terrified. What on earth would this be about? I had done some teaching of film when my position before that was at the University of Hong Kong. So I knew something about teaching film in an American studies context, but I really had no idea what he was after. And he propelled me into a field that I didn't know about, but that was huge and diverse, albeit not in the Jewish world. So for many years, Christian scholars had realized, theologians, seminary types, had realized that they were losing their congregants to another temple, right? So instead of being at church, people were at the movies. And they were trying to figure out a way to harness that interest in culture at large and make it part of what they were doing in church life. So to take cinema with a C and turn it from cinema with an S, right? So many preachers saw movies as threatening to the gospel. And so how might they engage this material theologically? And I was propelled into a world of extant Christian literature that employed this method of watching movies and then looking to see what would Jesus say about this, right? And basically, the word theology in almost all of these books was defined as Christianity. It was just de rigueur. And so every single book that I read used culture to basically talk about the Christian gospel. The other alternative were books that were very ecumenical and distant in their approach, you know, anthropological. Let's observe how going to the movies is a kind of religious practice, in the way that going to the baseball game can be a religious practice. And let's look at the attendant rituals, the turning off the light, the popcorn is a ritual food, you know, that was one approach. I was interested in trying to figure out a way, and it was surprising for me to find out that while, of course, with all the Jews in Hollywood, there are many books about Jews making movies, or books about Jews in movies, but there was not a single book out there that could be that would be analogous to the some 40 books in the Christian world that looked at a film in terms of its religious content and then moved to the question of what Judaism might say about the same topic. And so this was a collaboration that began together with my colleague Eugene Borowitz. And I didn't know at the time. He didn't really explain to me. He didn't deal his hand, but he kept it, in a sense, hidden. I didn't entirely understand until I began seriously writing the book what he was after, what was at stake in this mission. And then I started to actually go back to his earlier writings, and in fact to some of the things that he was writing at the time that he was making his proposition to me, to find out what he was after. And so I'll refer to some of that. It's always, unfortunately, he passed away the day before this book was accepted for publication.
Wow.
I did manage to get him to write a foreword, and there's a section at the back that details our email correspondence when the course was being developed, and some of the films that we taught over the years that didn't make it into the book. But it was important for me to really understand where our work fit into the larger liberal theological project. And we merged two worlds, because he is this staunch representative of Reform Judaism, and I come from a modern Orthodox background. So even the fact that he was interested in collaborating with me that way was significant and moving, and I don't know, an example of interdenominationalism that we would all be better if we saw more of that. So what I realized is that early on, in the 1970s, Gene Borowitz was trying to figure out a way to move liberal Jews away from just what he called like a Noahide way of being in the world, a kind of universalism that didn't have any Jewish particularity. He observed that many of his congregants were excelling at assimilation, and they were failing at specific Jewish practice. And he was trying to urge them, while being of America and being open to all that American culture has to offer to retain a stance that was still authentically Jewish. And so here's a line that I want to quote for you that will help us frame what we're going to do together tonight. So this is what he wrote in his book, The Mask Jews Wear, which won the National Jewish Book Award in the 1970s. Today, mankind desperately needs people who are creatively alienated. To be satisfied in our situation is either to have bad values or to understand grossly what man can do. Simply to be opposed to the system leads to quixotic protests that work to entrench the established wrong and promote despair and passivity. Creative alienation implies sufficient withdrawal from our society to judge it critically, but also the will and flexibility to keep finding and trying ways to correct it. I think Jewishness offers a unique means of gaining and maintaining such creative alienation. So he felt that Jews, in their capacity both to be very much part of America and the culture at large, could still nevertheless adopt this posture of creative alienation that would allow them to intervene at those moments where you needed to have a critical capacity and say, you know what, I like this part of the culture, but this part does not dovetail with my values. So in terms of our work in real theology, the idea was to find the works that were out there in culture at large that were moving, that touched upon an issue of central concern to moral lives, to religious lives, and then figure out a way how this could be associated with specific Jewish teachings. And the method that we developed, we gave it the term inverted midrash. Inverted midrash. What do we mean by that? Obviously, midrash is a very wide, multifarious type of commentary. But we were specifically referring to the common habit of the rabbis after they give a gloss on a particular verse and offer a first or second form of commentary to then add on a little story bit. So they'll often say, Mashal l'maha davar dumeh, a parable to what can it be likened, and then go on to tell a universal folktale that has no Jewish specificity. So they move from the very specific Jewish or Hebraic textual matter out to the culture at large. That's the common rabbinic move. We decided to do it in reverse. We would begin with the story. What the version of our world, our folktale world, is this. When we started writing the book, it was movies. Now it's really TV, right? Or streaming movies. So the idea is start with the work, choose well, to cultivate a habit of a critical faculty to begin with. It's not all works that really deserve or can bear the weight of this kind of examination. And then, after understanding the work on its own terms and what it raises, then move to some sort of Jewish application. Often a biblical passage or some issue in Jewish theology or some rabbinic material. It depends on what it is that you're watching. And so that became the method. What I want to do for you, it's always more fun and meaningful to be able to interact with you, and the benefit of a small group is that you get to do that. We're going to look at a few clips from the film that I used for the first chapter of the book, and we'll enact this application. I'll just say, for those of you who are interested, before I go into the specific example, I'll give you examples of other movies that I deal with. So there are 11 chapters in the book. Each chapter is a close reading of a different film, and then a close reading of related Jewish takes on the matter. So there's a chapter, for example, on the film The Descendants with George Clooney. It takes place in Hawaii, and that engages questions of birthright and legacy. There's a chapter on the film Memento, the Christopher Nolan film about a character who has short-term memory loss, and it's about the ethical imperative to remember in Jewish tradition, so Jewish notions of memory. There's a chapter on Crimes and Misdemeanors, the Woody Allen film from 1988, about notions of sin. There's a chapter on The King's Speech, where I do an analysis of Moses's stutter and the whole question of leadership, or what sort of speech can actually bear the weight of the word of God. There's a chapter on a British thriller called Exam, which looks at the spiritual value of tests in our tradition, including a somewhat counter-traditional reading of the Akedah. There's a chapter on The Hunger Games, which was a phenomenally successful film, and then a phenomenally successful book series and then film franchise that looks at the notion of being created in the image of God and how that undergirds a morality that would be, that would stand against murder. So that gives you an example of the other chapters. What I want to focus on is the very first chapter I wrote, and a topic that it really has, I've been obsessing over lately because of our current political moment. The film is The Truman Show, and the theme is the subject of truth. As I think you can all agree that this is a vexed topic in the current political moment. So we're going to look at a few clips from The Truman Show. I'm going to tell you how it is. I'm going to summarize very briefly what it is that I do with the film in the book. And then we're going to do something that actually isn't in the book. Because I think the great thing about good works, you know, art in general, and certainly Jewish studies, is that the consideration of it doesn't end. We don't deplete it just because we send a manuscript off to a publisher. And in fact, if the issues are significant, then they continue to live on. Now, how many of you have seen The Truman Show? Some of you haven't seen The Truman Show. Okay, so that will be important for me to get you up to speed. So The Truman Show came out 20 years ago. It's actually quite amazing to think about how long this film has been out there. And the basic premise of The Truman Show is that there's this character. His name is Truman Burbank. And he doesn't know this, but he is the lead character, the protagonist of a reality TV show. His whole life is a television show. He was a baby adopted by a film studio, and actually every single thing about his life around him is an elaborately staged lie. So there's this tremendous irony that you have a character whose name is Truman, and yet everything about his life is a lie. And this is signaled to us because his last name is Burbank, right? So he's a creature of media, of the Hollywood studio. So this film comes out in 1998. This is well before reality TV has become the most de rigueur regular thing, right? So the film is prescient on many, many levels, right? It predicts that reality TV will be something that will grip the world. It predicts that media can rule, in a sense, that create whole communities, grip everybody and manipulate everybody into their worldview. I mean, nowadays we live in a media reality TV presidency, right? So this film was predicting all of that. For those of you who haven't seen the film, as you can imagine, the point of the film, the plot trajectory of the film, is going to be Truman's journey from lie to truth. His coming into awareness, a critical awareness about the way in which his entire life is conditioned by the media around him. So he has to come to discover that. Now, the other thing about the film that's important to see, and we're going to look at the very beginning of the film, we're going to pause at various moments, because one of the convictions behind the book and the class was that it actually matters for people to get together and pause and do an analysis of film culture. Why? Most of us want to watch movies precisely for the very opposite reason. We want to vacate. Right? The idea of recreation is to not have to do this kind of thinking. The problem is, the power, both the great power and the great liability of this image culture, is that it overtakes you completely. It's the, you know, film is one of the few genres that's so mimetic, that's so realistic, that pulls you in so entirely that you're in the dark in the conventional watching experience, that it If one doesn't intervene into that process, then one loses all critical capacity. And so part of what this film is doing is it's commenting on that, on that whole process of audience participation, how the audience play a role in the propulsion of the narrative. And unless that's disturbed, it's just a never-ending, a series of concentric circles of influence and shaping our minds. So how does one ever step outside of those concentric circles? The film, the Truman's life takes place in this biosphere, this world, this manufactured world. Outside that biosphere is the audience in the film, the audience that's filmed in the film, that are, let's say, they're in the second concentric sphere. And then we are the third, out watching the film of the film of the film. And so, on, you know, one of the arguments of the movie is that you have to somehow break out of that. And yet, how can you? Because you're watching a movie. It's a movie that's critical of movies. On some level, it concedes that we're all conditioned by media culture. There's no way to ever break out of that. And yet, the way that you can break out of that is in groups, where you pause and analyze and notice how this thing is working, how it's put together. Right? Film is one of these genres that's composed of many, 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 many frames that are stitched together into a seemingly seamless unit. And yet, the way that one actually learns how to watch film is to be aware of some of the editing and some of the frames and the choices. Right? So we will pause, we will, in a sense, try to leave the biosphere so as to understand some of the messages that are being communicated. We'll look at a kind of sequence from the beginning, and if it looks like you guys have energy, maybe another one, and then we'll talk about what it can teach us Jewishly. Hopefully, after all of our prep.
Hopefully, okay, we're there.
Hopefully we're hearing it too.
Hopefully we'll hear it too, right. We heard it before, so.
We might want the fan off.
Yeah, we'll see.
Well, this...
We've become bored with watching actors give us false emotions. Tired of pyrotechnics and special effects. While the world we inhabit is in some respects counterfeit, there's nothing fake about Truman himself. No scripts. No cue cards. It isn't always Shakespeare that's genuine. It's a light.
Okay, so this is Christoph.
Can you make it louder?
I wish I could.
Oh.
Can we?
We tried before and then just kind of got messed up. And turn it on. I mean, it has to be while it's running. And I will try to...
I'm not going to make it. You're going to have to go on without me.
Is that better? Let's see.
No way, mister.
There we go.
You're going to the top of this mountain. Broken legs and all.
Yeah, that's the best. That's better, right? Yeah, okay. Now we're there.
Okay, so I'm just going to push it back a little because I want to...
No scripts. No cue cards. It isn't always Shakespeare, but it's genuine. It's a life.
Okay, so that's this. The person who is speaking at the very beginning of the film is Christoph, who is the creator of a television show. The creator of it, that's how he presents himself at the very end. And he is speaking right now to the audience within the film. Every so often there are like infomercials. There are a lot of commercials. There's a lot of product placement. Everything is for sale in Truman's world. So it's advertised. But this is one of these specials about the Truman Show where various people from the cast speak to the audience, the television audience. And we watch that on in the third concentric circle. So Christoph will have to talk about him because he is the creator character in this film, the one who knows all and can manipulate all in Truman's life. And he is making an argument about Truman's authenticity. Now, did you notice anything about the way he spoke or any particular affectations?
quiet and...
I'm going to play it again so that you can pay attention. I'm giving you this question. Pay attention to his affectations.
You feel part of the world or Cronkite to me.
Okay. That's giving him a lot of credibility.
It is.
Become bored with watching actors give us phony emotions. I'm tired of pyrotechnics and special effects. While the world he inhabits is in some respects counterfeit, there's nothing fake about Truman himself. No scripts, no cue cards. It isn't always Shakespeare, but it's genuine. It's a life.
Okay.
I'm really serious. I'm really thinking about this.
I'm very sincere. Okay, on the one hand, there are these moments where he looks straight at the audience, and he's, I'm leveling with you, I'm really, and of course his face is very big, close up on him, which gives a sort of credibility and intimacy when the camera is so close.
It's also a poetic meter. It's a it's like the same corner, and he says, so it's like set up a real... Effective language.
Okay, now at this point, this is the very beginning of the film, so we don't know what to make of this guy. At this point, his ability to hold sway like this and speak directly to the camera, it commands a lot of authority. Mm-hmm. Now, note that in addition to looking straight on, he also has this affectation where he looks up to the left.
Mm-hmm. Thinking.
You know, I'm thinking man. Mm-hmm. Like this kind of artist, he's wearing the beret, this artistic affectation of looking up to the left. Mm-hmm. Right? Which... if one cultivates something of a cynical, a little bit more suspicious take, suggests that he can't really keep his eyes on you the entire time. And we are going to find out over the course of the film, certainly Truman, who doesn't even know that he exists, he doesn't know that he's being filmed. He doesn't know that there are 4,000 cameras on every part of his life, in every place in his house, in his car. You know, he doesn't know any of this. We are clued in earlier. Right, and we are meant to develop this critical stance even before Truman does. It gives us a hint that we ought to be a little bit suspicious, that there's some spin going on here, right? Using the trope of authenticity in a very insincere way. Did you want to say something in the back? No?
No, go ahead.
That the content of what he's saying is setting up a straw man. Essentially, he's creating a false...
So he's saying that we're tired of scripts, that somehow there's something fundamentally insincere, inauthentic, lying about scripts because they're fiction. As if the reality TV show that they are, that they've created without this person even knowing that he's being filmed, to the point where his wife, he marries someone because it's manipulated, he, right, everything about his life is conditioned and manipulated. Of course this is not real. And yet it's the argument that they make for the consumers of that culture, that it's real, and therefore you should give it more credence. Okay, now we are going to have interpolations, so you'll have the people in the cast speaking, and then you'll have Truman himself, footage of Truman as his life is being filmed. And that's also important to watch. This is Truman, Jim Carrey. most of us know Jim Carrey at this point. We know him for absolutely zany comedy. And so it was a really interesting choice to cast Jim Carrey in this role, somebody who we'd expect to be going, you know, all kinds of nutty things, and yet this is a serious role. There are moments where he has to act crazy, but by and large, this is Jim Carrey's moment where he becomes a different kind of actor. Yes?
Who's the director of the actual director?
The actual director of the film, thank you for asking, is Peter Weir, who directed Witness, that film about the Amish. The screenplay was written by someone named Andrew Niccol. It was nominated for an Academy Award way back. Pardon me?
Picnic at Hanging Rock.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here is our first introduction to Truman himself. He's being filmed in his bathroom in the morning. Not on the toilet, God forbid, but speaking to the medicine cabinet.
Too real.
That would be too real.
I'm not going to make it. You're going to have to go on without me. No way, mister. You're going to the top of this mountain, broken legs and all.
If I made yours leave him on all night for comfort.
You're crazy, you know that.
Well, for me, there is no difference between a private life and a public life. My life is my life, is the Truman Show. The Truman Show is a lifestyle. It's a noble life. It is a truly blessed life.
Yeah, tell me something I don't know. All right, promise me one thing, though. If I die before I reach the summit, you'll use me as an alternative source of food.
Okay, so first of all, do you all understand what Truman is doing in talking to the medicine cabinet? Do you all get that? Okay, so Truman is living in this very limited life. If you watch the film, you'll see that it's all calculated to be a kind of 1950s throwback. Everything about the film actually presciently seems to have a kind of make America great again sensibility, as if there was a time back then when life was better. The place is called Sea Haven. It's surrounded by a sea, he thinks, but it's all very controlled. And he, as a young boy, has this penchant throughout his life to be an adventurer, and yet they block it all the time, because if he's an adventurer, then he's going to want to leave. Whenever he tries to do anything, like climb a mountain, they try to stop him. They drown his father to inculcate in him a sea phobia. But he continues, because he is a free and sentient being, even when controlled by an authoritarian TV producer director, he has an independent inner life, and so he's imagining mountain climbing, climbing Everest. Being in a situation where they've run out of food, you know, if I fail to reach the summit, promise me that you'll use me as an alternative source of fuel. So he's imagining this great, you know, potentially lethal trip. All the while, people are commenting on his life, and there are these really interesting juxtapositions where someone will say, you know, where Christoph will say, there are people who keep this on all night for comfort. And he goes, tell me something I don't already know. Right? So there are these little ironic juxtapositions that are, I would argue, are meant for us, the audience outside the film, to recognize the contradictions and to become more and more suspicious. Now, what do you notice about what's inside this medicine cabinet?
It's all cosmetics.
So this is all stuff for sale. He's wearing pimp pajamas. There is a message here being sent that there's a kind of effeminization of Truman in this life, right? Taming and using his life to sell a lot of things for women.
It's all real. Nothing here is fake. Nothing you see on this show is fake. It's merely controlled.
So we've been introduced to two important characters. His wife, whose name, did you notice what her name is? Meryl. And his best friend, whose name is Marlon. Why? Meryl and Marlon. Or think about a more recent movie star. Meryl Streep. And Marlon Brando, right? Everyone around him, the names of the characters, the people in his life, are a clue to us that they are all a Hollywood creation. Truman does not know this because he's been conditioned by Burbank.
Eat
Okay, there was a lot that was just broadcast in that moment. Okay, so he's getting really goofy, talking about, okay, don't eat all of me, just eat my love handles. Do I have love handles? You know, this kind of stuff that you should be doing by yourself, that goofy part of ourselves that we preserve for ourselves. And yet for him, it's an entire worldwide television audience that gets to see this. In the meantime, as he's riffing, what does he hear?
His
wife. And how does she sound? Truman, you're going to be late. Okay, more like his mother. So the implication of the film is that Truman is kept in a kind of infantile, adolescent, at best, state in living the life that he's living, right? Where his wife is more like his mother. And in order to individuate, he's going to have to separate from the world that's been presented to him. How is he going to do that? How does someone like Truman, shall we say, see the light to be able to exit, you know, see a different kind of truth?
Oi.
It's like a prison sentence.
Good morning!
Morning! Good morning!
Oh, and in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night.
Yeah. Morning, Truman! Morning,
okay, Sam. So what about that formula? That's every morning he says that.
Uh-huh.
In case I don't see you. Good morning, good evening, good night. What does that suggest? That kind of talk. I guess that a repeating formula.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean the prospect of if I don't see you, maybe there's, I don't know, you know.
Oh.
Something might end. Mm-hmm. I'm covering my bases because I don't know what's going to happen.
Okay, that's really interesting because at the end, when he finally does leave, spoiler alert, I'm sorry if you come to a class like this. when he finally does leave, he says that, but as a way of saying, if I don't see you, good morning, good evening, and good night. And that becomes kind of the open and close parentheses of the film. At this point, though, it's a kind of goofy 1950s sitcom formula, right? He's been taught to dress and to speak according to these goofy Leave It to Beaver type conventions. All right, so that's every morning he sees the same people. The dog jumps on him, you'll see. And it's all the same until something will jog him out of that.
Sir, people don't
know. No,
get down. Keep on, hurt. Get down. Yeah, I know. It's just me.
Come on.
Pluto.
Okay. So this is the moment, at least in the current iteration of Truman's life. There had been previous moments when he was younger, when there were intrusions from the outside that threatened to disrupt his illusion. But up until now, the studio has been able to keep it, to control it, keep it at bay. What is it that's fallen?
A light.
Okay, a light. Right? So here is Truman seeing the light, grasping the light. Right? Not, of course, it says Sirius on it, so that also implies, you know, some kind of constellation from above. He's needing to grasp that light. And that becomes the moment where he is launched into this journey of new understanding. Okay? Now, what will happen, I'm not going to spoil everything for you, but he will eventually figure out what is going on, and he will, despite the sea phobia that's been inculcated in him, he will take a sea voyage in an effort to escape the world that he lives in. So I want to just look briefly at the sea voyage, and then we'll talk about what it is that I, aside from the close reading, what it is that I do with this film from a Jewish point of view. It takes me a while to get to the right place. So he manages to escape, even though they have him monitored. You see, this is a search party for him. And they figure if he's escaping, given that he has this sea phobia, there's no way that he's going to go to the water. Well, they're wrong, because he's really determined.
Why are we looking at the water?
Good.
Go to the cabin. There, perfect. It's our hero shot.
I'll note that there is somebody that he kind of falls in love with in for real in the film, and he keeps on trying to find her. She's watching. Okay, notice the outside of the boat.
Let's get another boat out there.
Okay. The outside of the boat says. Okay, so this casts Truman's voyage as if he's Christopher Columbus going to see a new world. He's recapitulating the Renaissance. He's going from the Dark Ages to the broader world. Of course, now on the one hand, this is great theater. The fact that he's escaped is awesome for the show. On the other hand, he's going to escape. So they're trying to negotiate a desire on the one hand to keep the drama going on the other, to stop him. And so what does Christoff do?
Program.
We're going to be accessing the weather program.
Got that? No. I think we're going to want to localize the storm. Over the boat. You can get the coordinates for that.
There's no rescue boat. You won't know what to do.
They'll turn back. I'll be too afraid.
But you'll do the
danger. There she blows.
So unfold a whole scene where this unbelievable storm is unleashed onto the boat. Truman struggles because he's so intent on finally escaping. He just plows on. He screams out to the camera, you're going to have to do better than that. You're going to have to kill me. And so becomes this war, this battle that is unleashed between Christoff and his creature. Right? So much of what the film does is it avails itself of common old-fashioned theological notions, right? So this is this God of Sea Haven is a creator who sees all, you know, knows all, can control the weather, right? And have the weather do its work on his recalcitrant messenger. He can cue the sun and bring the rain. And his name is Christ of. So kind of, he's a kind of Christ. In other words, one of the ways in which one can read this film as an argument for the need to debunk all of those notions of religiosity, right? If God is omniscient, omnipotent, God, the Judeo-Christian God cues the sun and brings the rain, that's a false God that needs to be debunked. And that Truman becomes a true man in the Renaissance sense. He becomes a true man in liberating himself from this infantile sort of belief. Now, of course, I'm teaching this in the context of a rabbinical seminary. Right? So if that is where I want to go with it, we might as well close the shop. Right? So what is it that I actually want to get out of teaching the Truman Show to rabbinical students or to Jews that have an interest in the ongoing development of Judaism? So one of the ways in which I, on the one hand, I acknowledge that as modern people, there's a need to debunk a notion of a false God, right? The naive, simplistic theologies ought to be rejected in favor of a more nuanced understanding of God. All of us, you know, if you want to continue being religious after 12 or 20, you have to be involved in some kind of modern adult engagement with your theology so that it continues to live with you. And one of the ways in which I decide when I teach this to my students, or I have in the past, the way I wrote about this in the book, is to pair it with a biblical story that involves a man on fleeing from a message, shall we say, who goes to see to flee a God whose message he does not want to buy into, right? Who finds himself subjected to a very serious storm on a boat, right? So I look with the students at the figure of Jonah to talk about an analogous figure. Why is Jonah such an apt analog? So I mentioned to you our protagonist in the film is Truman Burbank. True man. He has to learn to become a true man and not a lesser man through this journey, through this development of critical insight. What is Jonah's name in the Bible? His full name? Ben-Amittai. Jonah's name actually is a version of Truman, but son of my truths. Not Emmet, but Amittai. Jonah, and so that when we, in the same way that names are a very important clue to how one, the reader, or the audience of the film should orient one, him or herself to the plot, Jonah's name clues us into what is going to be his central conflict, what his main issue with God is going to be. Why do I mean that? At the beginning, we don't know why Jonah is fleeing, right? Eventually, we find out that Jonah is fleeing because he can't suffer after he finally is forced to go to Nineveh and bring the message. And he finds out that the Ninevehites repent, you know, on a dime, in spades, the entire city, in fact, the animals, the children, everyone repents more than anyone could even imagine. He gets very upset. He said, "That's just what I meant, God. I knew that you were like that." And he specifically refers to God as Rav Chesed. God is having great compassion, but does not include the word emet in reference to God. Now, and we know from being conditioned, the 13 attributes of mercy, that it's Rav Chesed ve'emet. He specifically lops off emet because for Jonah, the idea that this God could have one position on the Ninevehites one day and a different position on the Ninevehites the next day is a departure from truth. He would want to imagine a truth that was absolute and unchanging. And the idea that truth in the book of Jonah is contingent upon human behavior, that God adapts God's justice and truth in response to human behavior as something that he can't suffer. And he prefers, you know, to die. Mavet for him is preferable to what he considers to be this bastardization of truth, the lack of an absolute truth. So part of what Jonah teaches us, I would argue, among many things, part of what it teaches us is this notion of the malleability or the plurality of truths in response to human behavior. When I, in my book, the two conclusions that I come to about truth are, number one, apropos of the Truman Show, that there is empirical truth that one can observe, right? You just have to train yourself to know what empiricism is. You know, your eyes can tell you things. Your eyes can be a guide as to what is true and what is false. There are facts and there are lies, and Truman comes to learn those. What Jonas teaches us is another message, which is that divine truth is contingent, changeable. It's subject to revision or interpretation. So we have an interpretive tradition that allows us 70 faces of the Torah. Or we have Hillel and Shammai debating, and they're both of their positions are referred to Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim Chaim. They're all living words of God. Where our ruling comes down in one direction depending on the context, right? Or depending on, in the case of Hillel, it's because of their goodness and their morality. So I really, those two principles, number one, that there is something known as empirical truth. Number two, that interpretation is a pluralistic affair, that Judaism revels in pluralism and in unfolding interpretation. These were the kind of baseline principles of my book. And what has been agonizing me since 2016 is that both of these notions of truth, number one, the empirical, and number two, the pluralistic, have been harnessed to very cynical, almost nihilistic ends, right? There are those who suggest nowadays that, you know, science is not to be believed, right? Reports that you see right in front of your eyes are not to be believed. We actually have video technology that's going to make it impossible for us to be able to trust what we see anyway. So on the one hand, empirical facts are threatened by those who reject, let's say, climate science or expertise. On the other hand, this idea of pluralism in interpretation, my narrative and your narrative, right? I got my position, you got your position, has led to a world where you have a cynical manipulation and spin. So how does one find truth in this environment? This is one of the things that I've been agonizing about. And as a result, 2 weeks ago now, when was it? Over Veterans Day, we had an event at HUC in Los Angeles, a symposium on truth that I organized with a colleague of mine, where we brought all these amazing Jewish studies scholars and journalists and scientists. We had television writers, everyone to kind of come together and figure out how we can salvage some notion of truth in this moment. What truths can we lay hold to? What values can we claim that are not, on the one hand, just cynically rejected or spun, you know, to the extent that we can't even recognize them anymore? And so with that in mind, I actually have been thinking about different sources of truth, because the Jonah story, which leaves me at this place where Jonah just doesn't recognize. He's Ben Amitai, son of my truths, and yet he thinks it's one truth, only one truth, and he has to learn that there are many truths. For some reason, that I can't sit comfortably with that anymore alone. Something else needs to intervene for us to put a shape, like to tame this beast that seems to have spun out of control. This, shall we say, Truman gives us a clue about the media industrial complex that is to come. We're now living in that media industrial complex. So how do we get out of the many, many concentric circles and that embed us to have a critical perspective? So with this in mind, and we'll just spend 5 more minutes on this, and I'm happy to ask to entertain more questions. I'd like to spend a little bit of time reading from this source sheet that was passed out. So the first source is taken from Psalms 85, and it begins with this almost paradise-like notion, this realm, or this once upon a time, when Chesed and Emet met together and lived as if they went on a date and hung out with one another. They weren't at cross purposes with one another. And so loving kindness or kindness and truth met, and tzedek and shalom, righteousness and peace, kissed each other in the past. Right, and it seems to me that the work of Midrash that I brought, here's our inverted Midrash moment, where we're literally going from the folktale to the Midrash. This, the way I've understood this Midrash is that Rabbi Shimon, or Simon, is trying to get a backstory for why it is that that's in the past, why it is that we may not actually live in a world where kindness and truth meet, or that where peace and justice are kissing each other. And in fact, Rabbi Simon seems to suggest that from the very earliest moment in creation, a conflict was staged in human history between principles of justice and truth, between principles of righteousness and peace. So can I ask somebody from the crowd to read this in English? Number two, the Bereishit Rabbah 8:5.
Okay. Rabbi Simon said, at the time when the Holy Blessed One came to create the first human, the ministering angels formed themselves into groups, some saying man should not be created, and some saying man should be created. As it says, kindness and truth met, justice and peace kissed.
Okay, so here, Rabbi Simon is actually imagining a very different reading than the one that I posited. He is actually seeing the fact that chesed and emet are specified as separate things, and tzedek and shalom are specified as separate things. That must mean that these are warring principles from the get-go. And so the angels don't want humankind to be created because fundamentally in human nature, of course, this is paradoxical, because if God's creating humans, maybe why couldn't God work it out that they wouldn't be this way? Right, this is kind of the flaw in the assumption. But let's go with it for a second. They worry that human beings will not be able to live up to any kind of truth principle or any kind of peace principle or justice principle, right? So one group of the ministering angels are saying man shouldn't be created because they're always going to, well, keep on reading and then we'll talk about it.
Kindness said, man should be created because he does acts of kindness. And truth said, man should not be created because he is all lies. Mm-hmm. Justice said, man should be created because he does just acts. And peace said, man should not be created because he is all quarrels. What did the Holy Blessed One do? God took truth and threw him to the ground, as it says, and truth was thrown to the ground.
Okay, it's interesting that I took this translation from somebody, and so I wonder why Emet would not be feminine. Threw her to the ground if we're feminine, you know. Imagine this. The angels, we imagine the angels being peaceful. The angels are worrying up in heaven over this, and God wants to settle the argument. And God's decision in order to settle the argument is to throw truth to the ground. And a proof text is brought from the book of Daniel that specifically says that truth is thrown to the ground.
Does he take from that the same thing as he threw him under the bus? I mean, is that the import of that passage?
Well, in fact, actually, the ministering angels respond to that and they say, to God, Master of the Universe, why are you disgracing the chief of your court that way? Why are you throwing truth under the bus? Right? The chief of your court, meaning truth would be the principle, the highest principle in the divine court. So why would you choose, of all things, in order to settle this argument, to exile truth from heaven? And the end point of the Midrash is God responding, they say, bring truth back from the ground. If you've thrown truth down, bring truth back up. So the compromise position is the second verse from Psalms. So Psalms 85:12 is truth springs from the earth. Emet me'eretz titzmach. So it's in the nature of things that grow from the earth to go upwards toward heaven. And the rest of the verse is v'tzedek mishamayim nishkaf, that righteousness will look down from heaven. So if the truth is growing up this way and the righteousness is coming down this way, it's like they'll kiss again in the middle. Right? The question is, why would God want to throw truth to the ground? What is the message of that? Why would that be a good thing to do? To exile truth from heaven? Or to have truth grow from the grass? Okay, so that would also speak to this idea that divine truth should not be an absolute that hovers above in some inviolate, unchanging way. That takes us back to the pluralism thing. Right? That means it's going to be up to human beings to make that truth happen. But can we leave it to human beings? Are human beings going to, you know, reliable? Do we think that nowadays that human beings are reliable to be guardians of that truth if it's coming from the ground?
Truth, I think, for human beings can't be an absolute principle. It's like you can't look on the face of God and live. If God is truth, it means seeing everything totally clearly. And speaking truth would definitely be a source of quarrels.
So that's part of the reason why, by the way, you have an inevitable argument between chesed and emet, because often we fudge it a little so as not to hurt people's feelings. It's in the nature of politeness, of getting on in the world, of peace.
It's like, do you want to be happy or do you want to be right?
Right. So, and then in this case, truth can be the enemy. In all seriousness, truth can be the enemy of the good.
Mm-hmm. Perfection. It's righteousness that is in heaven that remains in heaven. That's the ultimate thing, is the righteousness, not the truth.
So when but, I, yeah.
When they're in conflict with someone, this is saying righteousness should win out.
So I'd like to suggest, I want to hope, and this is one of the big ideas that came out of our symposium 2 or 3 weeks ago. I think it's an important one. It almost sounds commonsensical, but it's worth mentioning. One of the scholars who spoke for us, Christine Hayes, who is a professor of Talmud at Yale University, she presented some 12 different sources from the Talmud that showed moments when the rabbis were willing to fudge the truth for the sake of some other value. And those values often can be seen as falling under the rubric of the good. It's not nihilism to have truth be malleable or pluralistic, as long as the principle of the good is intervening and conditioning it. I think where we see cynical spin or manipulation or a lack of credibility is when things are spun or when things are interpreted to serve some sordid end. But if there is a principle of goodness or a principle of peace or a principle of decency that undergirds it, then the truth can come to serve that, right? Truth itself, the way she presented it, the idea of an absolute truth that hovers over all, like a mathematical type of truth, a philosophical truth that would be universal and applicable in all circumstances, that was a Greek notion. That was not a rabbinic notion. The rabbis were interested in avoiding such a notion of truth because it would be a kind of idol. It would be a final principle that would be warring with God. What I think this Midrash, and actually the way in which it dialogues with Psalms, the way it works is that the goodness principle is the final word. So if you look in verse 13, it says, Gam Hashem Yiten Tov, Hatov. God, too, in this context, where human beings are doing what they can to cultivate the truth from the ground, and heaven is actually doing its part to bring the righteousness down so that they meet, in that context, God will give goodness, right? Goodness will be present there. And I find that at least at the tiniest little anchor to keep me from feeling as though I'm adrift in this sea of nihilism nowadays. I think that I actually believe that even gatherings like this, where people get together and try to crack their heads over these issues, that they're a kind of evidence of a commitment to the good, right? To be honest about sources. especially in our fast-paced world, where most of the time we're walking around with our heads in our devices, right? We're not even a one-screen world anymore. We're a five-screen world. We're not noticing one another. And just the very act of talking about a story with other people, pausing over it, not running through it, letting it just, you know, be something that you pass through, a kind of like cyber highway that you rush yourself through to get to some other place and that you've given no thought to. Just that act itself, to me, is a good. It's a cause for the good in service of a truth that is real. So I'm happy to answer.
Take a couple questions.
I'm happy to take answer questions. I'm happy to sign books if people are interested.
Well, we'll do that right after we're finished with questions.
What was the other movie that you wanted to, that you were going to talk about?
Not tonight. I was only planning on talking about this. I you know what, it's tough enough to be able to get through one properly. And this was only a little snippet. Usually, you know, when I teach it at AGC, we have a 2-hour period. The first hour dedicated to the movie, the second hour dedicated to the Jewish textual study.
How did the class respond to this curriculum?
It's a popular class. You know what? As you can imagine, I teach rabbinical students, right? So rabbis are looking for ways to draw their congregants into something that would be fun, but also Jewishly edifying. So I already have many generations of students that are telling me about the classes that they teach in their congregations, and I've gone around the country giving classes like this. And in fact, not just to in Jewish contexts. I spoke at Oklahoma City University, which is a, you know, a Methodist college in Oklahoma City.
These rabbis giving homework before Shabbat, saying, "Watch this movie. I'm going to talk about it."
Well, you know, it's a common thing. There are many rabbis. Anyway, it's not as though I invented that. There are many sermons that begin with references to, you know,
every week
to this film and that film. But you know what? That is. That's a kind of throwaway, and I don't want to denigrate that. Whatever's going to get people interested in having them, get them sitting up in their seats. But for me, there's a big difference between talking about a film as a way of nodding, you know, the New York Times quotation, the film quotation, and actually engaging it in it seriously, taking it seriously as a work of art. And again, it depends on what it is that you're... You can't do this with every stupid movie. You know, you can't do it with Dumb and Dumber.
Right? Yes, you can.
Well, maybe.
Hell yeah. That one you may actually be able to.
Well, you know. It's interesting because I was watching on the plane. Next semester I'm going to be teaching a new iteration of the course, and because the book already came out, I'm bored with a lot of the things that I've already written on, and plus it upsets me to speak about things I've written on because I can't do anything in it anymore. I can't improve it unless I get another edition. So I'm going to be teaching a lot of new things, including the Netflix series Stranger Things. And so Stranger Things apparently is an homage to a Spielberg movie, The Goonies, which is a really goofy kind of movie.
The Goonies.
Yes. And I was on a plane just 2 days ago and I watched The Goonies on the way back. And that's a silly movie, but actually it's pretty profound in the context of... So you never know what it is that you can talk about seriously. I think there was someone in the back here.
Wait, I gotta think about it for a second. Hang on. Now, I was just curious because you mentioned that Peter Weir is the director of this film, and is he from New Zealand or something? My guess is he's not Jewish, right?
Not. And I don't teach, generally speaking. Most of the movies are not Jewish films. It's not the idea.
It's the content that you're looking at. Completely.
So there are a few. So the Woody Allen movie in this book, Crimes and Misdemeanors, has Jewish content. It was a film that mattered a lot to Gene Borowitz. He was enlisted. There were three theologians that were asked to write about that movie in 1988 in the New York Times, and he was one of them. And so it was a movie that he noted it was one of the first positive portrayals of a rabbi in film history. And it's not an entirely positive portrayal. So that's one instance where we actually spoke about a Jewish film. I also have a chapter on A Serious Man. Mm-hmm. So that's a Jewish film.
But by and large, we were more interested in the non-Jewish films, because the idea was to find people, to find what's out there at the culture at large, not to only look in the Jewish bubble, to see the profound works out there in the culture that engage serious issues of religious concern. And there are many, many. And then there are the films that are, you know, because of the way in which they're created, there are scholars that talk about the transcendent mode in film. And, you know, so visually transcendent.
What does that refer to?
Refers to Ozu, the Japanese. There's a Paul Schrader, the director of Taxi Driver, you know that, like famous. Mm-hmm. He wrote a book called The Transcendent Mode in Film, right? or Film Transcendence. Mm-hmm. And he looked at certain kinds of film sensibilities, certain kind of narrative sensibilities as profoundly religious, but not in a particularistic way. He wasn't thinking in terms of a particular religious tradition.
Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Wendy. This is absolutely wonderful. Those of you who are still looking